Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Mark Graber, Senior Fellow for Healthcare Quality and Outcomes at Research Triangle Institute International, about making the right call and diagnosis, something that I'm really looking forward to and maybe help me make the right call.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that too. But first, Adam, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about jaw support, different treatments for obstructive sleep apnea.
Yeah, something they call MAD, and we'll define what that is. Hopefully we're not going to be
mad.
And second, we're going to be talking about if you have emergency surgery, how can you cut down on your chances of being readmitted to the hospital?
And we're also going to talk about psychiatric patients being screened for diabetes. Are we giving different care to different populations?
And finally, Christy and I are going to give some of our top tips for the healthy holidays. Looking forward to it. We haven't compared notes, but we'll find out.
We haven't. I can't wait. Okay, first let's talk about sleep apnea. So hopefully many people know that patients sometimes will have daytime sleepiness related to not getting quality sleep at night from something called obstructive sleep apnea, or OSA. It's often tied with being overweight, but it also can happen to people with normal weight.
And one of the most established treatments is called CPAP, or continuous positive airway pressure, which really keeps the airway open as people breathe. But it's a device, and it requires people to have a sleep study and get fitted with the device. And sometimes people don't like it, maybe think it can be uncomfortable. But that's the standard gold study. And what this particular research that was published in the Lancet Respiratory Medicine Journal compared treatments that were done for this CPAP for sleep apnea with other treatments, which called a mandibular advancement device, a device that moves the jaw forward to keep the airway open, and that's called MAD.
Yeah, and they found by looking at 67 different studies with almost 7,000 patients that, yes, the CPAP is the preference. It had greater reduction in daytime sleepiness for people who wore that CPAP machine. But there also were gains and decreased daytime sleepiness in people who were wearing this MAD device.
So MAD can be as good as a CPAP in this particular area.
Yeah, but not as
almost
good,
as good.
Almost but better good. Than nothing. So many people say, oh, I don't like the machine. I can't wear it, la, la, la. And then they don't do anything and continue to feel poorly. But this is another option to say, okay, well, if you can't do the best thing, then at least do this. And it can make a difference.
Do people really say la, la, la?
They do, actually. I'm thinking of a family member who said it was going on, and the la-la-la was more me trailing off, like, okay, I've heard
my
this.
My mom used to say, Adam, come back from la-la land. But
that's
anyhow,
right.
Let's talk
my
about our next
that
research that matters. And this is a really an important area, but it's about the patients and friends and family members who have surgery, emergency surgery, such as like a appendix removal or gallbladder removal. And then do you end up back in the hospital after you've been discharged?
Yeah, so the truth is, yes. And we're trying as a public health approach to really think about readmissions to the hospital. Someone comes in and gets surgery, they want to go home and have that behind them. Nobody wants to go back in there for a variety of reasons. In this case, they looked at over 177,000 patients that were adults. Again, as you mentioned, there were most commonly an appendix removal or a gallbladder removal that brought them in for surgery. But the majority of them, of 17% ended up, the ones who came back, 17% of them went to a different hospital. So that also adds other questions. You're going to a whole different group of doctors to a different system.
And right, and 6% of them actually were readmitted in general. Over 10,000
right.
of these 177,000
right.
actually even came back to any hospital. So And a lot of them went to different hospitals. So this was a huge problem. And a lot of the most common reason was because of an infection.
Exactly. A surgical site infection or a GI or a stomach kind of complication or a lung complication. Those were the three most common reasons for coming back. So it does raise these questions of what can we do to make surgery safer, make the discharge safer, to prevent or arrange follow-up or transition to the primary care world or to clinic for surgeons that can help prevent some of these things.
I think a take-home for a family member is if you're having an emergency surgery, really have a long talk with your doctor and the surgeon. Talk about this study in the Journal of the American Medical Association subspecialty journal called Surgery about ways of cutting down on infection.
Okay, we're going to talk about screening for diabetes. And so what we know is that patients who have mental health illness are often screened less often than people who don't. The thing about this study is that they're looking at this population treated with antipsychotic drugs, and these medications actually raise a person's risk for developing diabetes, and in many cases may be tied to weight gain, and that, of course, is a contributing factor to diabetes. And so this is a group that especially should be screened regularly because of those even additional risks.
This was in the Journal of the American Medical Association subspecialty journal, Internal Medicine, and 51,000 people also in California. We didn't mention that last time, but the other study was also in California. A lot of good study coming out of California.
They're doing
good
something
for California. But finding out that 30% of the patients who really should be getting this diabetes screening regularly did get it. Another 40% got it kind of sporadically, and 31% didn't get it, meaning missing a lot of opportunities for diagnosing diabetes early, and if we can diagnose it early, we can actually prevent some of the worst outcomes.
Well, now we're going to talk about some tips for healthy holidays.
So we're going to make a transition, and Christy and I, some research, not necessarily, but it's certainly things
from
that we've...
From our minds.
In our minds,
to
but
our
also
listeners.
We've experienced. We're going to call it our top three tips for healthy holidays, and Christy and I have not... Before, we've been in isolated rooms. We're not aware of what each one has written down.
I had more, and he said I could only have three.
I only had three. So let's talk about what's number one on your list, Christy.
Okay. Number one on my list is to make time to exercise. If you're a new exerciser, to give yourself even just a few minutes of walking with your family member. If you normally exercise, to not just turn it off and lay around for the next little bit, but to make sure you're making time, even on holidays, to do a little bit of moving your body.
So my first, and I like that one, Christy. Very, very good option. I like that. My first one is... As you're going to exercise somewhere, if you are driving there, please drive slowly. There's so many people on the roads for the holidays. Drive slowly, have your seatbelt on, and just take your time. You'll get there safe and sound.
That is very good advice. My next one was to take care of yourself over the holidays. And this I grouped in with making sure you're getting good sleep, that you're thinking about healthy choices around portion control, that you're doing things that reduce stress. If family members get you wound up, go out and take a walk. Go back to number one. Get a breath. Take care of yourself and make sure that the holidays are a time of joy and not of stress.
So, Christy, I like that too. And it kind of fits a little bit in with my second tip for a healthy holiday, which is kindness and smiling.
Oh, that fits in with my number three. Tell me more.
Well, I just think that, you know, there's so many things happening. People are rushing. They're driving in that car. Someone's cutting them off. And just a little extra kindness, a little extra smile. You never know what someone's going through. And that could go a long way towards maybe making someone else healthy and keeping you happy.
Well, that fits in with my number three, which was being in a posture of gratitude. And that can be a really hard time of the holidays for many people. And sometimes it's just stressful because we're too busy trying to get things done and miss those moments. But having something where you write down in a journal something positive or being in that posture of the blessings in life during that time can help you have healthy holidays.
Well, my last tip for healthy holidays, Christy, I'm going to have to tie it into your third one, and that's being grateful for the ability to wash our hands. And there are blessings for washing one's hands in different faiths. You say that because there's something about that. And, you know, we are touching so many things in the holidays, and everyone else is touching so many things, and there's germs, and there's all kinds of things everywhere. Let's just wash our hands a lot more frequently.
Yes, that would make me thankful if everyone around me washes their hands, too. Okay, well, that concludes the research that matters and our tip for healthier holidays. But we are going to take a break. But when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Mark Graber, Senior Fellow for Healthcare Quality and Outcomes at RTI International, about making the right call in diagnosis. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we'll be talking with Dr. Mark Graber, Senior Fellow for Healthcare Quality and Outcomes at RTI International, about making the right call in diagnosis.
Welcome, Dr. Graber. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks, Christy. Thanks, Adam. Pleasure.
Now, you have extensive expertise in patient safety and errors in diagnosis that we're going to talk about today. But how did you first become interested in these issues of physician safety, medical errors, and making the right diagnosis?
Yeah, I worked in the VA healthcare system my entire career, and there's a nice culture of safety in the VA. You can talk about errors, and there's definitely a sense that we're moving away from a culture of blame and towards becoming, you know, a learning organization. I was chief of medicine at my VA, and I was just running across every year many examples of diagnostic errors that seemed to me to be preventable or at least discussable. And at the time, they just weren't on the radar screen in terms of a patient safety issue.
Not on the radar screen because we were focusing more on medical harm or on other safety issues?
Yeah, you know, we all got started on this safety journey about 15 years ago with the Institute of Medicine report, To Err Is Human. And that report was a landmark, but it focused on, you know, I think I called it the low-hanging fruit, so it was things like falls and medication errors and hospital-acquired infections, all of which are incredibly important problems, and I'm just delighted that we've been able to make progress on those. But diagnostic errors wasn't really identified as a problem in that original report.
Well, when you think of diagnostic errors, help us understand what you're really talking about. And then we're going to kind of get into really, I think, a really important New England Journal of Medicine perspective article you recently wrote. But tell us what you mean by diagnostic errors.
Yeah, well, diagnosis is, I think, the most complex cognitive task that humans face because there's so much uncertainty at every step of the process. And there are 10,000 diseases or more and 5,000 lab tests. And making sense out of all that is incredibly difficult, especially because a disease plays out over time, and you may not have all the information at the start. In fact, it's rare that you do. So it's an extremely difficult process to begin with, just because of its complexity. And on top of that, it's taking place in our healthcare organizations, which are more complex by the day, and it involves cognitive effort on the part of physicians. And we're not perfect thinkers. We're not perfect decision makers. So these are all the reasons we have diagnostic error and why they're so common.
So help us understand, for our listeners, if I'm a physician in the office, I might see a person for their back pain, and I have some ideas of what it might be, and maybe I don't figure out the right diagnosis that day. Maybe they get better. I never knew exactly what it was. Help us understand with some specific examples when you say an error in diagnosis. Is that from one encounter with a patient, or is that an error overall that then affected the patient poorly? Okay. Or give us some examples.
There are several definitions out there. The one that I like, it's hard to use, but we're talking about diagnoses that are completely wrong or missed altogether or should have been made much sooner. But you need to have the gold standard in your hand. You have to, like, you know, find out 3 years later the reason that patient had back pain was because they had metastatic disease in their spine. And because we didn't diagnose it in time, they had spinal cord damage. It should have been diagnosed in a week or a month. We don't really have standards, but it took a year or it took 2 years, something egregiously delayed. So that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about cases where there's little doubt and little controversy, although there's no question that there are many, many cases in the gray area where people would debate whether it was made on time or it wasn't, or whether it was close enough to the real diagnosis or it wasn't. I'm talking about egregious errors that we would all agree upon.
You mean like you miss a case of meningitis? I mean, those are the sorts of things that one obviously leads to oftentimes malpractice, but you're not talking about things that always lead to malpractice.
No, malpractice is, I guess, the tip of the iceberg. It's one way we find out about diagnostic errors, but it's just one way. There's many other ways that we need to find these errors and identify them and start to learn from them.
Well, one of the things that I think patients hearing this might wonder, a lot of patients really want to know, why does my back hurt? I need an MRI, I need more tests. Or, maybe it's only been hurting that day, but people want to know why. And there's a big push, of course, if you go to the emergency department or other places, make sure you do a bunch of tests to try to at least exclude bad things and maybe try to tell the patient why. How do you relate this work with avoiding diagnostic errors with this, desire to do more tests?
Yeah, Christy, that's a great question. When we're talking about trying to improve diagnosis, I'm not really interested in getting a whole lot more tests. I think we probably get too many tests already. But I don't want to miss anything that I should be able to detect now and that would cause harm if it was delayed.
Exactly.
So we need to find that sweet spot where you're doing just the right amount of tests and the correct tests, but not too many. And that's a challenge. And right now we don't really have a good feeling for what is exactly the correct workup for back pain, or really any problem in medicine. Diagnosis has never really been the subject of study.
We
don't really know how long should it take to diagnose cancer or, a cause of back pain. Pick any of the particular causes you want. So we're kind of just at the start of this new day, I'd like to think, when we'll start thinking about that and start to look at what the variability is from one doctor to another or one healthcare organization to another. Try and arrive at some guidelines about how long it should take, what the accuracy rate should be, and we're never going to get to 100%. But I think we can do a little better than we're doing now.
You say in your New England Journal of Medicine Perspective article about improving diagnosis that there have been insights that have come from cognitive psychology, human factor engineering, informatics, and social sciences. Give us some examples of what that means, because it seems like you're saying we should learn from those that are doing work in other fields. What can we learn?
Oh, there's so much to learn. I really want to come back in 30 years when we have the electronic medical record story all figured out, because that's a huge part of diagnosis.
Sure.
And some people just love their EMR, and other people are tearing their hair out. But in either case, the medical record is right in the middle of everything we're doing with diagnosis. And we can learn a lot about how to use that more effectively to our advantage. I think the more actionable part for many people is just to understand what goes on cognitively when we make a diagnosis, because we make the same mistakes in our medical practices as we do in our everyday life. We try and take shortcuts. We jump to conclusions a little too quickly. We get biased by one thing or another. A patient may walk in and say, I think I have an ulcer. And that really biases us. We're going to focus a lot on ulcers, and it will tend to make us not think about other possibilities. So there's all these little, very human fallacies and biases that we all have a predilection to that I think if we learned a little bit about them, we might avoid them, or at least recognize them when we made those mistakes a little quicker.
Well, we're going to need to take a break soon, but I wonder, what have you learned about the value of continuity with a doctor? So if you have that pain or you're being evaluated, to be able to come back to the doctor if you're not better versus going to multiple different places. Do we know anything about accuracy?
You know, I do not have a study to quote you, but just in my own personal experience as a physician, I would say there is hardly anything more valuable than having a continuity relationship. If you know your patient and you know their usual state of health and their usual pain tolerance, it's just so valuable in terms of discerning when something has changed.
You know, we're going to need to take a short break now. But when we come back, we're going to continue having our conversation with Dr. Mark Graber about his work on understanding the right call and diagnose. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Mark Graber, Senior Fellow for Healthcare Quality and Outcomes at RTI International, about making the right call in diagnosis. And Dr. Graber, you have outlined several recommendations to help improve diagnosis. And one of them that jumps out, as we were talking earlier, is the value of the history and the physical for a physician. Help us understand these guidelines that you've outlined, and in particular, how it relates to teaching and performing a good history and physical exam.
Oh, sure. Thanks, Christy. You know, I think it was Osler who said that listen to the patient, they will tell you the diagnosis. So the history is just so important. And there's been various estimates, 70, 80% of the time. Some people say 90% of the time you can get the diagnosis just from the history. And it's such a shame in modern medicine that we're shortchanging that by, you know, production pressures. You only have 10 minutes with a patient or 15 or 20, and that may not be enough to hear their whole story. So I'm a huge fan of getting as much information as you can from the patient and letting them tell their story uninterrupted until you absolutely have to interrupt and start asking questions. There's also problems with the physical exam. We did a study of diagnostic errors. We found 100 cases, and 15% of the time there was a problem with doing the physical exam or just doing the simple parts of data collection, like just correctly interpreting the laboratory tests that were coming back. So the history and physical are very important elements. Although really that's not where the big money is. The big money is putting everything together. In our study, that was the most common reason for physicians to make a diagnostic error.
You know, you talk about in some of your recommendations, I just want to jump to it, more research funding. And as you were talking, it made me think of, well, has anyone done the study where they compare spending 8 minutes with the patient compared to spending 20 minutes with the patient? Does that actually improve diagnostic accuracy? And even though we would all say we want that 20 minutes, don't we actually have to prove it's worth it in terms of the diagnosis, or do we not?
Yeah, great question, Adam. Somebody needs to do that study, and they haven't done it yet. And I don't know why. It's such an important question. And we do know, for example, that if you apply pressure to people, like pressure of time, you have another patient waiting, you're behind schedule, it changes the thought patterns, the cognitive pathways that people use, so they tend to think less in a rational, deliberate fashion and rely more on subconscious intuition, which we think is a more error-prone pathway. So there's good reason to believe, for all sorts of reasons, that the more time you have, the better off you'll be in terms of making the correct decision.
And you mentioned earlier that one of the main areas of error is putting all the pieces together. So maybe the physician and team has gathered the history and physical exam, and there are lab tests to do, and the clues are there, but we sometimes miss it. What do we know about the best scenarios or the best way to make sure that we are putting those pieces together? Is it more about the team? Is it more about well-rested physicians?
Yeah, there's all sorts of interesting factors that relate to that, Christy. It's a great question. And the way we think about it now is that a lot of the diagnostic errors arise from intuitive diagnoses. So a patient walks in the door, and you just know what they have because it's common and you're so familiar with it. You know, they have a fever and a cough, and, you know, it's flu season and aches and pains. Okay, they have influenza. And we're going to be right over 90% of the time with that kind of thinking. But that leaves the other 10% of the time where we didn't think of what the correct diagnosis really is. So the ways to combat that are to practice reflectively, to slow down, and really consciously consider how you came up with the diagnosis. And I guess the universal antidote is just to ask yourself, you know, what else could this be? And in fact, we're encouraging patients to ask that when they see a physician and they're given a new diagnosis. You know, what else could this be? It kind of shakes you out of that intuitive automatic pathway that, you know, we've already said tends to be error prone.
You know, that's a wonderful, I think, set of challenges for all of us, and Christy and I as teachers of medical students and residents. And you also, I think, it really nicely say how patients can be in this model. One of the things, though, you say is that a big part in kind of helping to improve this and getting rid of errors is to recognize when they're happening. Okay, how does that work? I can be aware when I'm saying something wrong because it doesn't sound right to me. But how am I aware when I'm making a wrong diagnosis?
Well, most of the time we don't know, and we'll never find out because that patient is likely to go see somebody else and not come back to us. And there's no more autopsy. So it's a challenge. One thing that we think will be helpful is in medical school, and it can be done in the first 2 years, is to teach medical trainees, and not just physicians. This should be for everybody, the nurses, everybody who's going to be making a diagnosis, the cognitive shortcomings that have been identified in research studies. So these are things like premature closure, which is the jumping to conclusions that we talked about, the framing errors, the tendency we all have to discount evidence against our leading hypothesis. There's over 100 of these human tendencies that we all have that detract from optimal thinking that have now been identified and pretty well described. And we're thinking that, you know, if you learn these in medical school, I don't know if it would help you prevent a diagnostic error, but you would certainly recognize those kinds of mistakes when you encounter them again more quickly. And it would make you pause and think, whoa, I should have made a more comprehensive differential diagnosis. I should have, you know, got a second opinion from somebody.
And I imagine being in a culture where physicians are talking about this with each other, I mean, even in our own department, to be able to say, oh, that was an error of omission, or wait a minute, am I having premature closure here? Let me talk to someone. I mean, even using some of that language, I think, can make a difference for that transparency. I wonder, as our listeners are listening to this conversation, if it's scary to them or if it's like appropriately alarming to have them more engaged in the relationship with that doctor-patient scenario. What is it that our listeners should be taking away from this conversation?
Yeah, you know, what I'd like them to take away is just the thought that we are all error-prone, and whether we get feedback on them or not, we are all likely to make a diagnostic error with some frequency when we're in practice, and that we could probably do better if we thought about that and if we learned how our clinical reasoning processes are taking place in our mind, and if we got a little better feedback within our healthcare organization. So it's this susceptibility to error that I would like people to be more aware of.
You know, let me ask you just real quickly about the flip side of that, which is today physicians are increasingly judged about quality and patient satisfaction. And Christy mentioned how we want to really all be certain, but isn't there a certain amount of uncertainty inherent in the diagnostic process? And to what extent do we kind of artificially gloss over that? How does that fit together?
Yeah, great question, Adam. Well, you're absolutely right. There's uncertainty at every step of the diagnostic process. And in fact, we're never 100% sure of what the diagnosis is. Even autopsies are, you know, even though we call them the gold standard, are not 100% definitive. So we need to learn how to live with some uncertainty and to recognize the fact that we're always playing the odds. And it's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable for patients who, you know, they just want to know what I have. And it's uncomfortable for physicians who have an inherent distrust for uncertainty, and they're uncomfortable being in that state. But really, that's where we are. And I think if we just accepted that and learned to live with it, it would certainly be a more honest approach and a more transparent approach. And it would also open the door, I think, to catch more diagnostic errors, because if you told your patients, listen, this is what I think you have, I'm 90% sure, or I'm 95% sure, whatever it is, but if you said, you know, if you don't get better or if your symptoms change, I want you to come back and let me know about those things. So you need to give your patient permission and discrete instructions on when and how to get back to you if things aren't playing out the way you think that they should. And that would be a way, I think, to catch a lot of diagnostic errors. So I'm a huge fan of making the patient a partner in the diagnostic process. And some patients will welcome that, and some patients will find it for them. So you really do have to get a sense for what your patient's preferences and values are in that regard.
Well, we thank you for partnering with us and sharing some wonderful tips.
Thanks for being with us, Dr. Graber.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for the time.
We've been talking with Dr. Mark Graber, Senior Fellow for Healthcare Quality and Outcomes at RTI International, about making the right call in diagnosis. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Christy, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about our listeners' health questions and concerns.
If you have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments and questions to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call question of the day.
I'm a 61-year-old male, and I'm a little overweight. We just welcomed 3 new grandchildren into our family, which is a great blessing, but for me that means lots of long car rides and flights over the next month to go visit them all. My brother had a DVT a few years ago, and with all the traveling, I'm worried about getting one myself. Are there things I can do to help prevent that?
So first off, we're going to say, according to my faith tradition, Mazel Tov!
Congratulations on the grandbabies.
That's great.
That is great.
We're very
news.
Excited for you, and I'm sure that it's an exciting time, and you don't want to get ill. So thank you for the question.
Yeah, and so for listeners, the question is about a DVT, or a deep vein thrombosis, which is one of those blood clots that people can get in their legs and the deep vein system that can potentially be dangerous to one's life. And so you want to try to avoid getting one if possible, and if you do, to seek care. Long rides in a plane or a train or an automobile can certainly increase your risk of getting one. So making sure you're moving your legs is my first recommendation. Get up, frequent stops, make sure you're doing some exercises with your ankle or getting up to walk around if you have a long plane ride.
And the fact that your brother had one doesn't necessarily mean that you're more likely, but it would be good to find out what was the cause of your brother's clot, because it could have something to do with some genetics and put you at higher risk, and then you could find out if you should be tested. But I think in general, you should be okay as long as you stay active.
All right, let's take our next House Call question.
My spouse was recently in the emergency room for an abscess around their bottom. It was painful, and we were really scared. Is there any way to prevent this from coming back?
Ooh, this is a painful question, Christy, in more ways than one, because this is what we call a perirectal abscess. Even the name itself, just don't like it.
No, it just doesn't sound pleasant at all. So these are infections that get sort of walled off, or like a pocket of infection, which is what we call an abscess, that can happen. It can happen anywhere in the body, really, but it can happen in this case near the rectum, and can be caused by bacteria that get in there and grow and make this sort of tight infection that oftentimes needs to be released with some sort of incision with a surgical procedure to let the pus out, and sometimes antibiotics or warm compresses.
Yeah, a lot of times, unfortunately, unless you drain these abscesses, that's the treatment. And unfortunately, in this particular area of the body, things can kind of move for a pretty long distance because there's lots of space in there for things to grow and to move, and not a lot of air for them to get out. And so that's why they can sometimes be a lot larger than it appears and be more painful. Antibacterial soap maybe could be helpful. Looser fitting garments so that's not if that's an issue, if there's a lot of moisture there, drying things out, really maybe talk with your primary care doctor or your gastroenterologist or the surgeon about ways of preventing this. Because, boy, you don't want to have it come back again. I can guarantee you, and you can guarantee me.
Let's take our next house call question, Daniel.
My sister has really severe OCD. She worries incessantly about germs and infections. Our family doctor recently recommended a medicine called Effexor, but my sister doesn't want to take it. What do you recommend that we do?
OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. Boy, we've talked about this several times on the show, Christy. It's a very difficult condition that's actually really common.
Well, the first thing I'd want to know is why doesn't she want to take it? Is it some side effect or is it the concept of taking medication? What is it that makes her not want to take it? Because if we understand that, sometimes there could be a different medicine or a different approach. The other question that comes to me is, has she had counseling or cognitive behavioral therapy or any other health professional involved? Because there may be some things that she could do in addition to medication or instead of, if she's truly not willing, that could help her.
Yeah, we do know that this specialized type of therapy can be helpful. We also know that the medication, in this case, the Effexor, can be helpful, but only if she takes it. I wonder if one could say that your concerns about germs are likely to get better and really link it to those concerns. And then the other thing I would really say is sometimes we give medicines and we say, see you back in a month. In this particular case, I might really contract and negotiate about taking the medicine daily and calling in and checking in daily, maybe getting our pharmacist, if you have a pharmacist, to work with you and to help you. So maybe a coach could be helpful. I don't know.
It's a really good point. It's a tough situation. It sounds like she's very fortunate to have a family that cares about her. And hopefully you guys can make some positive movement.
Good point. Daniel, what's our very last house call?
My husband is on long-term pain medication and takes medication for anxiety. We recently saw our family doctor, and he told us that he had to get off one of the medicines and that the family doctor could not prescribe both. It seems a little unfair to us since we need both of these medicines.
Well,
such a common conversation these days, Adam.
It is. It's a common one, and one that I think, Christy, that you and I and our department has really struggled with lately. But we're kind of maybe agreeing more with this family doctor, and maybe we can tell you why. How's that work, Christy?
Well, I try to explain it to my patients because I have patients in this situation that have been maybe for quite some time on long-term opioid medications, morphine, OxyContin, methadone, all kinds of different medicines. They might be on a long-term medicine, but also on one of those benzodiazepines like Ativan or Xanax or Klonopin, one of those. And what we know now that wasn't as clear before, what we know is that being on both of these medications increases your risk of death. And I actually use those words, Adam, and explain to people that the reason these policies are changing is because of the uptake in the number of deaths in our country and our state from opioid prescription or those narcotic pain medications. And when you take out the ones who are on that and the benzodiazepines, it's even more pronounced.
You know, you're absolutely right, Christy. I've looked at kind of autopsy reports on and some medical legal cases, and the more drugs one is on, the more likely, particularly the ones that have central nervous system acting things, that think like alcohol or like even marijuana, you throw in this cocktail and boy, you can have real lowering of your ability to breathe and your heart to pump efficiently at much different levels than you would be thinking otherwise. So we're really becoming much more cautious. I applaud the physician for bringing up the conversation. I don't think they should stop that benzodiazepine necessarily quickly, maybe over 2 or 3 months to get you off of it so you don't go through withdrawal if you've been taking it every day.
Right. And it's also important to kind of work through with your doctor which one of these medicines is really helping you and which one is it worth trying to work on other strategies to maybe try to get off both if it's possible.
Well, that'll conclude, I think, the house calls today. Christy, we've had a really good chance to talk about a variety of things that hopefully are important to our listeners and concerns. And our listeners can share their own stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu or visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or just use our health app.
We want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Mark Graber. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page, and we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.